of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. My name is Dean Becker, and one more time we're going to look back at the recent 4th National Clinical Conference on Cannabis Therapeutics, the Mind-Body Connection. We're going to listen to Santa Barbara infectious disease specialist, Dr. Stephen Hosea.
I think it's critically important that we don't forget. I've had the honor of caring for many people who died of AIDS over the last 20 years. And we're doing much better now than we did many years ago, but there's 90% of people in this world who don't have access to the kind of care that we have here. And we can't forget that. I'm going to reflect on some of the experiences I've had in caring for people with HIV infection that continues to the present day. This is an introduction of what a physician's role, and I think this is really what a human being's role is really all about when you're with someone who is suffering in any form or fashion. I went into infectious diseases because it was a relatively happy subspecialty. I used to be able to give people antibiotics and they would get well and be discharged from the hospital or go back home. Then I moved to Santa Barbara in 1981 and spent the next 20, 25 years caring for people dying with AIDS. Didn't have any medicine to offer. All I had to offer that people could trust was the companionship. They could trust that I would walk with them wherever their disease took them. There's not any cures out there. There's still not any cures out there. But what it comes down to is what we all know, and that's relieving suffering, providing comfort, and doing whatever it takes to accomplish and achieve that. I have seen the benefits of use of marijuana in people who are HIV positive. I have had my eyes opened by this conference to the incredible other possibilities of the medicinal use of cannabis for so many other people. And it is absolutely staggering and remarkable to me, so I thank everyone who's here for that opportunity. AIDS wasting syndrome is defined in various ways, primarily characterized by greater than 10% body weight loss. And this was the harbinger of death in the past. It actually is known as Slim disease in Africa, because when someone gets Slim disease, they lose significant amounts of body weight, you know that death is imminent. You can see the relative characteristics that are present here. There's really no subcutaneous fat that's present. There's wasting around the cheeks that occurs, and there's dramatic metabolic abnormalities that are present. Well, with regard to treatment of this, the drug companies have many different offerings for taking care of wasting and AIDS, and each of them work relatively well. People gain somewhere between 2 to 5 kilograms, 5 to 10 pounds on these various regimens. Megace is something that we used a lot of. It's medroxyprogesterone. It's a hormone. It has lots of side effects, gives you primarily increased in fat body weight. Oxandrin is the latest oral anabolic steroid that we use a lot of, but you can see the cost of that, about $1,100 a month, is relatively significant. Serostim, this is really the high price spread. It's been marketed for wasting syndrome and HIV infection. You can see this costs $6,000 per month, which is ridiculous in its cost. This is driven by the pharmaceutical companies because this is how they make money. And this is how much of the research is done, because it's also driven by the pharmaceutical companies so that they can make money. The economics of medicine, I personally think, is an oxymoron, because really it's about caring for people. It's not about how much money you can make. And there are different agendas that people have who are really controlling a lot of the research done and what physicians and individuals are exposed to. In Santa Barbara, we used a lot of anabolic steroids, testosterone by injection to help with the wasting syndrome. And so people at least weren't dying, looked like they were wasted with kwashiorkor as a result of HIV infection. Marinol, we've heard a fair amount about Marinol. You see that it's still relatively high price spread. I guess there's a generic form that is somewhere in the works. We may or may not see that soon. 1 ounce of marijuana. Well, how much does that cost? The studies really haven't been done in wasting, or were not allowed to be done in wasting, to show its benefit in terms of weight gain. Inadvertently, I think we know that it does cause weight gain in some of the studies of its safety that Dr. Abrams has carried out. And again, the market price, depending on who you talk to, varies from moment to moment and location to location. The etiology of weight loss in patients with HIV infections is really multifactorial. There's lots of things we don't really understand about why this occurs. The metabolic demands are probably increased as a result of the infection, and as well as some of the opportunistic infections that were there. And this is pretty much a list that we know from the pre-heart era. And the pre-heart stands for highly active antiretroviral therapy. That's fallen out of favor recently, but it still sort of gives you the idea that we use multiple drugs to control the virus and therefore control the infection. These are some of the studies that were produced by drug companies, which is what the FDA demands in order to approve a drug for use. And you can see here by the bars that there is significant improvement in appetite and reduced nausea by using Marinol. This shows that there's also a significant, or there is some effect on weight gain, which did not reach statistical significance. It would have had more people been enrolled in this, presumably, and also has an effect on mood. It's amazing the extent and the amount of money that was paid to prove this particular point, which I think anyone who has had any experience at all with marijuana could vouch for. Well, weight loss is still a common problem in HIV infection, and I was actually amazed to find this recent study that was done that showed a third of people who are HIV positive, even if they're on heart therapy, still exhibit significant weight loss. And this has somewhat to do with the effects of the protease inhibitors and other medicines on probably the mitochondria in the body, which alter fat metabolism and are part and parcel responsible for the lipodystrophy that is seen in HIV infection. The weight loss of greater than 10% is associated with a six-fold increase in mortality. That's even in people who are on heart therapy. So weight loss is still a significant problem in HIV infection, even if people are on therapy. This just speaks to that and shows that, again, as the amount of weight loss increases, the mortality increases. And the best predictor of increased mortality is just absolute weight loss. You don't have to look at fat-free mass or body cell mass or fat mass. Just the simple number of weight loss is a significant predictor that there's going to be increased mortality. Again, it's a common and strong independent predictor of mortality despite heart therapy. Many individuals prefer to inhale cannabinoids, as we've talked about before, probably because of the pharmacology. If we could just get some of those other folks who would come out of the closet and support this, we'd probably have better results. Again, the majority of HIV-positive folks who report appetite stimulation is a major reason for using marijuana. Usual consumption, one joint three times a day, is sufficient. I actually had an interesting conversation with a man in my office on Tuesday, a 71-year-old man who is HIV positive. His disease is actually being controlled by himself. He's one of these people who I think may be a long-term survivor in terms of his own immune system able to control this. He's had some problems with depression, and he's had some problems with weight loss. And we were talking about this, and he brought up the fact that one of the guys that he met at the support group suggested marijuana to him. And so he's been smoking a joint each night to help control his weight. He only uses a joint a night, and he only does it when he's not feeling particularly hungry. And he asked me if there's anything I could do about that. Well, I got this huge grin on my face and told him, yes, we have several ways that we can deal with this, but I wrote him a prescription for the Cannabis Club. He was somewhat concerned, however, because he lives up in San Ynez, which is close to Buellton, and he was a little bit concerned about that's up North County, whether or not he was going to have access, but I reassured him that we had plenty of opportunity here in Santa Barbara anyway. So again, it's all about education and spreading the word, which is again why we're here. Some of the oxymorons that became obvious, synthetic marinol is approved by the FDA, but the official position of the U.S. is that marijuana has no medicinal value. Feds only allow clinical studies of safety, such as Dr. Abrams did with the protease inhibitors, an effect on mortality, but not the effectiveness of marijuana. That's what it really requires, is studies on the effectiveness in order to get it FDA approved, but it sounds like we're making some inroads with regard to that anyway. No death has ever been ascribed to marijuana, unlike many other FDA-approved drugs. In summary, weight loss is associated with increased mortality in the HIV-positive patient. Still occurs even in the area of highly active antiretroviral therapy. And THC, this is Institute of Medicine, simultaneously reduces anxiety, pain, and nausea while stimulating appetite. Smoking marijuana stimulates the munchies. Now, this is really the bottom line. And to what extent do we really need to go to prove this? Maybe the more relevant question is who do we need to prove this to and why? I have come to the firm conviction and belief that it is everyone's inalienable right to use cannabis, no matter what their condition is or what condition their condition is in. I wanted to, again, publicly thank Dr. Abrams, because everything that I know about this, he is responsible for, and he's been one of those people who really looked tenure in the face and said, I don't care, I'm going to go ahead and follow my convictions, which is what we're all about. So it's people like him who help clinicians like me care for people in the best possible way and the way in which they deserve to be cared for. And, you know, that's what being alive is all about. I don't care if you're a physician, if you're a healthcare worker, who you are or what you do. That's the final common playing field that we all come to, and that's truly what it's all about. So I want to thank Dr. Behrman for giving me the opportunity to speak here, and all of you all for honoring me by listening to me.
This is Dr. Donald Abrams.
As many of you know, for the past 14 years now, I've been trying to answer this question to generate evidence for the medical community that we live in that is so evidence-based. And what I'd like to do today is give you some updates on some of the clinical trials that we've done to investigate whether marijuana still is a medicine, as it has been for 5,000 years. Again, I don't think I need to reiterate to this audience that this has been used as medicine, cannabis, for centuries, for millennia. introduced into Western medicine by W.B. O'Shaughnessy, who Todd McAree extolled yesterday during his award ceremony. When it was first introduced, one of the indications or one of the suggestions was that marijuana had analgesic activity, that is, benefits people for pain in relieving pain. The interest in the use of marijuana in the Western world began to decline in the early part of the 1900s with the availability of other substances that had similar indications, including opiates and aspirin, for example, as well as syringes, which made the delivery of pain-killing medications easier. Somebody asked, I believe the mayor asked, what happened to hemp, and certainly what happened to marijuana was the result of basically one man, Harry Anslinger, who introduced the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937, which made imposed a penalty or a levy of $1 an ounce for medicinal use and $100 an ounce for medical use of cannabis. And this was 1937 dollars, so that was pretty significant. Interestingly still is the fact that the American Medical Association stood virtually alone in opposing the Marijuana Tax Act, saying that, in fact, any objective data regarding the harmful effects of cannabis were lacking and that the act would impede future clinical research, which certainly was correct. Up until 1942, physicians could still prescribe cannabis. In 1942, it was removed from the pharmacopoeia, and in 1970, with the Controlled Substances Act, it was placed in Schedule I, as the mayor reported. You're in California now. For those of you who aren't Californians, we had many people on the program who were involved in the language that was voted on in November of 1996, where 56% of the state voted for medicinal cannabis. There was definitely a gradient with the northern counties more in favor. In San Francisco, 77% of San Franciscans voted for medical cannabis, 71% voted for Bill Clinton. So you can see. The Compassionate Use Act allows for the right to possess and cultivate marijuana for medical purposes where medical use has been deemed appropriate and recommended by a physician. And the list for which cannabis can be recommended in California includes the treatment of cancer, anorexia, loss of appetite, AIDS, spasticity, glaucoma, arthritis, migraine, or any other illness for which marijuana provides relief, which I believe Todd took, that he put that one on the ballot. So when I began to investigate medical cannabis, and it was really at the push of Rick Doblin, who spoke yesterday after lunch, Rick sent a letter, just for those of you that don't know how this happened. Well, I'll go back a step. I was in Amsterdam, of all places, in 1992 at the International AIDS Conference, and I was looking at CNN headline news, and I saw Mary Rathbun on the news being arrested for making marijuana brownies. Mary was the volunteer of the year 2 years in a row in our clinic at San Francisco General Hospital, our AIDS clinic. She lost her only daughter to a drunk driver, but was definitely pro-marijuana, and she used to bake brownies for her kids. She called them our patients at San Francisco General Hospital in the AIDS clinic. And Mary would wheel our patients back and forth to X-ray and take their prescriptions to the pharmacy, and she would also dispense marijuana brownies. And she was known as Brownie Mary. And there she was being arrested. And when I came back from Amsterdam, there was a letter written to the chief of research at San Francisco General Hospital AIDS program, which I wasn't, but the letter worked its way to me. And it was from Rick Doblin, the president of the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, and it suggested that a clinical trial showing the medical benefit of marijuana should come from Brownie Mary's institution, as if she were our dean. And, you know, it was 1992. We only had three drugs to treat HIV, and I had already studied one compared to the other and people who had failed the third. So there wasn't much to do. So I picked up the gauntlet, and I started this journey to investigate whether marijuana or to demonstrate that marijuana does have a medicinal benefit. And many of my colleagues said, gee, Donald, you know, we don't smoke digitalis anymore. Modern Western medicine is about extracting the active compound from a plant and then, you know, industrializing it. And for a while, I didn't know what to say to that. But subsequently, my interest in medicinal cannabis has caused me to pursue sort of more advanced education in integrative medicine. And in 2004, I finished a two-year associate fellowship with the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona, Andrew Weil's program. And I learned a lot more about botanicals. And now I understand that when you extract the active component from a plant, you really take it out of the balance that nature gave it. And you remove it from the yin and yang. And you remove it from the supporting stroma of other compounds in the plant that may balance the effects of one single agent that's removed. So it doesn't bother me that marijuana as a medicine has many, many active components. Again, we know that the most psychoactive is delta-9 THC, but clinical studies from Raphael Machulam's group in Israel have demonstrated that delta-8 THC, which is not present in dronabinol, is just as effective in treating nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy in cancer patients. And as we've heard yesterday as well from Dr. Piamelli, in addition to the cannabinoids that come from the plant, we also make our own cannabinoids, just as we make our own opioids, our endorphins. We form these endocannabinoids, our body's own cannabinoids, on demand as we need them. And they participate in a wide range of biological processes, and they are subsequently degraded when they're no longer needed. Now, this is a schema which shows the synthesis of endocannabinoids here and how they act on the CB1 receptor. And I just want you to look at the various activities that they're felt to be involved with. Control of appetite, immune function, muscle, pain, intraocular pressure in the eye, cognition, emesis, which is vomiting, neuroexcitability, reward, and thermoregulation. The CB2 receptor, the other receptor that's been well characterized, is more involved in immune function, but you can see here it also acts to modulate inflammation and pain. So in this discussion this morning about the use of cannabis in pain and palliative care, of course, meaning care for patients at the end of life, you can see that the endocannabinoids and the CB1 and CB2 receptor provide us with a huge amount of potential and possibility to influence patients dealing with end-of-life situations. Now, many of you may appreciate the fact that most of my career before medical marijuana was involved with HIV research, but in fact, when I finished my residency, I became an oncology fellow to become an oncologist or a cancer specialist, and now cancer has really drawn me back, and I'm spending most of my time in research doing oncology. And in cancer, if you just look at these list of symptoms, this is a drug company slide, but it shows you symptom management challenges associated with cancer, and it couldn't have been a better slide for, you know, showing the benefits of cannabis. So the symptoms that are listed are weight loss, cachexia, which is, as we know, weight loss, early satiety, which means getting full quickly, anorexia, which is loss of appetite, moderate to severe pain, anxiety or depression, and acute nausea and vomiting. So most Western physicians would say, gee, we need 7 different medicines for this. But guess what? There is one medicine that takes care of all of these different symptoms. But we live in this evidence-based society where everybody wants evidence to before anybody will act to do anything differently. The evidence with regards to dronabinol, delta-9 THC in sesame oil, marketed as Marinol, was good enough in 1986 to have that drug approved for the treatment of nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy. Now, 1986 was before we had our more potent anti-nausea drugs available that we have today. In 1992, on rather slim evidence, the indication for prescribing Marinol was increased, and I think it's important to read the words, for the treatment of anorexia or loss of appetite associated with weight loss in patients with AIDS. It's not for the treatment of weight loss, because in the placebo-controlled trials that were conducted, dronabinol did not lead to increased weight compared to placebo dronabinol. It led to increased appetite. So whether or not there is a benefit of having an increased appetite if you don't gain weight is something that is unclear, but this was in 1992. 1992 was the year that there was a potential flood about to be unleashed on the compassionate use program. So the government shut that down, and then to say that there is something that we can give patients, they said, here, we'll expand the indication for Marinol, even though the evidence was really not that strong. Well, when we started giving our patients with HIV-related wasting Marinol prescriptions, they'd all come back and say, you know, it's okay, but it's a little bit difficult to regulate, and it makes me awfully zonked. And if we look at the pharmacokinetics of THC taken by mouth, our patients were right. In general, the bioavailability, or how much gets into the bloodstream, is low, 6 to 20%, and variable. The peak concentration of THC that occurs in the plasma following an oral dose occurs at about 2.5 hours after it's taken. So if you're trying to take this to increase your appetite for breakfast, you sort of have to get up pretty early if you want to have an increased appetite. Also, when taken by mouth, THC, whether it's dronabinol or whether it's baked in brownies, is degraded by the liver into a bioactive metabolite, an 11-hydroxy-THC, which isn't formed as much when it's smoked. And that's why people, when they take Marinol or eat brownies, tend to be more sedated than stimulated, if you will, because of the increased production of this secondary metabolite. So that's why many of our patients in the early 90s were frequenting Dennis Perone's huge cannabis buyers club in San Francisco, and many of those that sprung up when Dennis's was closed to obtain actual marijuana instead of Marinol. And again, what we know is from the kinetics of smoked THC that the peak absorption occurs at 2.5 minutes after smoking, with then a rapid decline, compared to what you get when you take it orally, where you have a much lower peak that lasts for a much longer time. And smaller amounts of the 11-hydroxy byproduct are found. So not only can patients titrate the effect better, but there is a cleaner effect as well. I feel that because I know people are sort of wary about smoking a medicine, that we're going to alter our cannabinoid opioid study in cancer patients so that instead of smoking the cannabis, we'll vaporize it. So that's our next step, and that's the team that's been working with me. And, you know, again, I think if we're generating the evidence, we've generated evidence of efficacy of smoked cannabis in HIV-related peripheral neuropathy in a placebo-controlled trial, and now we've demonstrated that vaporization is safe and effective in delivering cannabinoids to the bloodstream. We're now moving on to look at this interaction between cannabinoids and opioids. So we're generating a lot of data. The next issue is getting it published, which doesn't seem to be easy, but I've fought this fight before, and we will prevail. Thank you.
Once again, that was Dr. Donald Abrams. If you would like to hear the full 90-minute presentation on the mind-body connection, please visit our website, which is drugtruth.net. In closing, I state once again that there is no truth, justice, logic, or medical data to validate this drug war, and nowhere is that lack of evidence more evident and glaring than in regards to medical marijuana. We have been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Please do your part to help end this madness. Prohibido ist Doc Ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.